Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, August 22nd. We hear from the Navy about the detection of a new class of chemicals in its underground monitoring wells around the same time that it turned up in a shuttered drinking well in Aiea. We hear about the efforts of the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation as it marks 5 decades of fighting to preserve Native Hawaiian rights. We get the latest on the efforts to roll out sterile mosquitoes on Maui in this, the year of our native forest birds. And a familiar singing voice on the airwaves returns to the islands to join the local group Seven Suns. We catch up with Justin Kavika Young. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Navy intends to keep its remediation schedule outlined in a Red Hill work plan approved by state and federal regulators. It comes amidst calls by the Honolulu Board of Water Supply for more frequent testing of its monitoring wells. HBR was there at an open house meeting last night. I spoke with Rear Admiral Mark Williams, a Navy Closure Task Force Red Hill Deputy Commander. Williams told HBR he disagreed with the calls for weekly testing because of the detection of a new class of chemicals called PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We heard from Board of Water Supply Chief Engineer Ernie Lau and Deputy Director Erwin Kawada earlier this week, who are calling for weekly testing because of the PAHs. Neither the EPA nor the State Health Department think that it's necessary right now, but the issue is expected to come up at a future Fuel Tank Advisory Committee or FTAC meeting later this year.
We have a network of about 40 monitoring wells in place in and around Red Hill. Our data is not congruent with what Ernie and Erwin in the Board of Water Supply is claiming that it is coming from Red Hill. That is not what we're seeing in our data. Now, that said, we are aware that both DOH as well as EPA have requested additional information from the Board of Water Supply, additional lines of evidence that would support, you know, their finding or their conclusion that the PAH detections in those two wells are coming from Red Hill.
Around the same time that the Board of Water Supply detected it in the Aiea wells, you folks also found some traces in the groundwater monitoring wells, which is right under the tanks, right?
There are a couple of wells depending upon where in the hill. So we have a couple of monitoring wells right under tanks and then layers outside, right, of that. So sort of think of it in terms of the network that we've established of those 40 wells are positioned in ways where the goal of that is, if there is contamination, is to find it, figure out where is the plume, what's the size of the plume, characterize that plume, is it moving, in what direction is it moving, how fast is it moving, and so forth, so that then you can make risk-based decisions of what kind of remediation efforts do you have to undertake, what kind of threat is there to the aquifer, if there is one. So that's the design of the groundwater watering well network, and we will continue as we go into FY, our fiscal year 2025 and then beyond, continue to expand that network so that, again, the goal is to find if there is, and we know there's contamination. Navy's never said otherwise, but there is contamination, so let's find it. Let's figure out where it is, where it's moving. Those detections that you referred to, there are, I think, a handful. We do continue to see triggers in specific monitoring wells. Again, the important thing is you look at that, you trend it over time. Is it a one-time thing? If it is, okay, are there other factors? Was there a significant rain event and so forth? So you continue to just evaluate the data, come to the best scientific conclusion you can, and that informs your decisions.
Has the Navy come to any conclusion yet? You know, or has your contractor determined that was a one-off, or are the contaminants still popping up here and there?
And that's what I would say, there's no final conclusion. I mean, it's an ongoing, as the site assessment goes through and the site characterization, it is a continue to monitor and collect information. You know, think of it in terms of you cast this net and this well network, and we know there's contamination out there. If the well that you drop in the ground is not right in the plume, it's not going to detect it. Now, as the plume migrates and it would move through that or that well and you do the sampling, you would be able to identify it. And so there's a little bit of you know, wait and see. The important thing is you have a robust well network around there. So should there be movement, we can detect it and we can identify what it is that's moving.
Okay, but no conclusion yet. I understand that there have been a number of instances where the sampling came back positive and hired what you would want to see in there. What steps have you taken to address that where it's turned up?
So a few things, right? So one, we are accelerating things like our soil vapor extraction, other emerging technologies and evaluation in therein. We will go through as we do the site characterization and the field investigation work over the next 12 to 18 months, that will really then determine, hey, where do we need to be aggressive? What are the emerging technologies? Where should we take proactive steps to do remediation? Where should we should monitor? And again, wait and see type approach. There'll be all those things. With regards to the PAH detections in those wells that are kind of northwest of where Red Hill facility are, you know, PAH can become from a lot of things. Asphalt runoff, significant rain events, and so forth. So again, PAH is also usually generally slow moving. It wouldn't be a contaminant that would move fast through groundwater. And so again, hence why when we look at our data and we evaluate what the findings we are seeing, it's not congruent with what BWS's claims are. That doesn't mean it's not final here and there. We all collectively, I think, need to get together and get all of the data and evaluate all the data before reaching a final conclusion.
Can you give us a status on where the report is on the flow models? You know, Ernie was concerned there should be some sense of urgency because I think we've been going around in circles for the last decade or so. So where are we at?
So we submitted a draft to the regulatory agencies, Department of Health and EPA, with a chance to review and comment. It is a lengthy document. They've provided some initial comments back. We're going to incorporate and take that feedback, and then we will go live with a published final version of our groundwater flow model in September. We intend to brief that at FTAC in October. And then in addition to that, there is an independent third-party study that's funded through the Office of Naval Research that the University of Hawaii is working towards. I think right now their timeline is sometime in the latter half of 25, they would complete their model. And those two models really, I think, will do a good job of informing scientific-based decisions on what to do from a fate and transport.
Anything else you want to add or underscore to our listeners?
Look, I would just say, you know, we're here. You know, the Navy Closure Task Force's mission is to bring this facility to a closure and decommission, right? And then long-term environmental remediation. You know, every day we wake up trying to do the right thing. I mean, that's the solace we have. We recognize at times that it is unpopular, but at the same time, right, we are trying to do the right thing, and that's what guides us.
You know, this issue is also expected to come up at a meeting tonight with the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative Group. Chair Marty Townsend was on hand at the military open house last night and shared her concerns.
Well, I'm very concerned about the discovery of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons in the AOL. The AOL for the Board of Water Supply was not previously contaminated, and now it has contamination. In my mind, you know, the massive fuel facility is the most likely source. I recognize, appreciate the regulators, you know, keeping an open mind and looking at all potential risks, but it would be foolish for us to not act on the most obvious culprit as soon as possible. You know, if the Navy had followed through after the 2014 release and doing a high-quality groundwater monitoring plan, and if they had put in the monitoring wells that they said they were going to do, we would have more information at this point. But because they didn't do that, we don't really know how the groundwater flows underneath, and we don't have enough monitoring wells to be able to keep track of this plume. They have no idea where the fuel went. It could have sunk deeper into the water. It could have spread. They don't know. This detection they had in that AOL is the first, like, indication of where the plumes might be going. And for me, I'm thinking about the PAH is one indicator, but there are all kinds of chemicals associated with the fuel that could be coming along with it. And the fact that it has moved, so it's a plume that they saw briefly and then now they can't see it, says to me that it's reason for concern that our water is at risk. We don't know what happened to the 2 million gallons worth of various kinds of fuel that have been released since the facility was built and, you know, their first leak happened in the 1940s. So there's a lot of fuel risking our water right now. We do not have a good assessment of where it is, and that's part of the fundamental problem that we have here. What really aggravates me is that the Navy knew that there was PAHs in their IAO well that had shut down, and they didn't notify anybody. You had to find it buried in their website. Similar with other contaminants that people should be really concerned about, like lead. And this is water that they're serving to people. So, you know, the Navy still has a long way to go to really rebuild public trust. And really, if they were actually interested in doing that, they would follow the entity that has the most public trust right now, which is the Board of Water Supply. The Board of Water Supply has an excellent track record in protecting public health and our water supply. They are asking the Navy to follow the same same testing protocols that they are, a weekly testing, you know, using a third-party evaluator and, you know, using the kinds of tests that will help to identify the things that we're looking for. If the Navy could follow suit, follow Board of Water Supply's lead, not only would we be able to compare apples to apples in terms of the contamination and trying to find where it's going, but also the Navy might be able to rebuild some of the public's trust. As it is right now, I just don't have it.
Also at last night's meeting was Na'alehu Anthony, the chair of the directors of the Honolulu Board of Water Supply.
I mean, I think it's important to understand a couple of things, right? And the first is to get a really good sense of where the Navy is at now that they're done with defueling, with the cleanup and the, you know, the last bits of what they're doing and tank cleaning and the like. And then to really think about that in the time space of just under 3 years and what that means for the rest of the missing fuel that is as many as 2 million gallons over the last 80 years, right? And so I think your reference earlier was to the contaminants that we're seeing in our IA wells, which have been shuttered since the spill in November of 21. I think we closed in December of 21. And that, you know, those wells are 2.1 miles out. And, you know, there's plenty of people who say that, like, that's too far, that, you know, you would see more of it and the like. And what we're saying is, like, you know, I think it's a reasonable place to be where we ask for more testing at a higher frequency, meaning weekly, so that we can get a better sense of what might be moving as a trend. I think it's reasonable for us to ask for that of the regulators, both the Department of Health as well as the EPA. And it's also reasonable for the Navy to want to do that as a good community partner. We can all acknowledge that, you know, 19,000 gallons of fuel spilled in November of 21. Question is, where did the fuel go? You know, where did the fuel go? And how is that going to affect our aquifer, which is our primary drinking water source for this island long term? I would call out the Navy and the regulators to say that they've been dragging their feet the last 10 years for all the science that we need, the particle tracking, the groundwater modeling, and the like. Like, we should have that data already to better drive good decisions as to what might be going on in the ground underneath us. I would also say that the Red Hill VI, of which I'm a member, produced a document a year ago that is urging the Navy to pay for long-term monitoring and, you know, several dozen, if not a few hundred, monitoring wells to better understand the contamination in the ground. Yeah, we don't know. And I will say to you, I hope we're wrong. I really hope we're wrong. But if we're going to be reasonable and cautious, then we have to treat this like it could be a really important beginning to a trend that is not going to be useful when we have other drinking water wells in the vicinity. So we want to know better, and we'd like everyone's help to understand the nature of this as soon as we can, because as it turns out, the fuel can move faster than the bureaucracy can.
That was Na'alehu Anthony, chair of the board of directors for the Honolulu Board of Water Supply. He was on hand last night at the open house meeting for the Navy Closure Task Force Red Hill. This issue will come up again tonight at the CRI's group meeting. The EPA and state health department officials will be there. The Navy is not expected to attend.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting humorist, author, and comedian Paula Poundstone of the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me this Saturday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
Munich is famous for its beer halls and Oktoberfest, but lately it's having a sober moment.
There is much more drinks which are non-alcoholic, and there are much more people who enjoy non-alcoholic drinks.
Alcohol-free beer is all the rage in the German city. We'll bring you the buzz on Buzz-Free Beer next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
The Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation celebrated its 50th anniversary this month with a gala in Waikiki. Its mission is to protect and enhance Native Hawaiian culture. The Office of Hawaiian Affairs provided its seed money, and it has, over the many decades, won key cases. Its most recent challenge was over midwife rights. We sat down with its executive director, Makalika Naholava'a, to reflect on its progress and how its recent event was part birthday party, part backyard pa'ina.
So we really did have, you know, people from the very beginning, and one of our executive directors, Mahia Went, who was ED for about 20 years, you know, she was there with her great-grandchildren. You know, so that family alone had four generations sitting at one table, and it was just beautiful.
When you think about the cases that you folks took to court and won many of them, tick off some of those really milestone wins for the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we have had, so just in the last year, we had four appellate-level decisions come out. You know, in a 50-year history, the list of appellate-level decisions we've had bearing out issues of Hawaiian rights is multiple pages. So I hesitate to pick out ones that were more important than others because that's just not fair and not the way that we think about it. I mean, our philosophy is really that, you know, every sacred space, every burial, every Hawaiian homestead is important and affects whether or not our culture is perpetuated in that community or that family for the rest of time. So I want to kind of make sure that I frame it in that way because we're not an organization that's just chasing sort of the flashy national news or even statewide news kind of case. Although it's good for us often when that happens because it means that the issues of our community are getting the respect and attention they deserve because they're often very, very serious. When I think about the last decade, you know, probably the things that are the top of mind for people are the work that we've done to protect Mauna Kea, which is a whole combination of issues. It's not just about, you know, the 30-meter telescope, but it's about the Hawaiian homelands around it. It's about supporting the kupuna that were impacted by arrests and getting access to the services they need. And that was definitely not just led by our firm. I mean, something as large as that, there's been numerous legal organizations and attorneys involved, but that definitely would probably be on the top five of issues we've worked on. You know, another thing that I would say for sure is water rights generally, but specifically in East Maui. So, you know, we've been working on litigation for years to help traditional Native Hawaiian farmers to get water into their streams that has been diverted and used for all kinds of commercial, agricultural, and residential development that literally caused the streams to run dry, you know, and all the practices that depended on those streams. So there's been a ton of work that, again, like Mauna Kea, continues to protect millions of gallons of water a day that has been diverted for years, impacting those practitioners. We also continue to be involved in Pohaku Loa and, you know, a case that, you know, really called for the military to clean up its mess there and the way that it's impacted Hawaiian homelands in that location. So it's back on Hawaii Island. You know, let me see, other big things that are still going on today. I mean, we were very proud to participate in the Nelson litigation that, you know, really held the government accountable for properly funding the Department of Hawaiian Homelands so that people could come off the wait list. You know, far too many people died on that wait list. People continue to die on that wait list every day. And so holding the state accountable to funding DHHL so that it could properly execute on its fiduciary duties to get Hawaiians into homesteads is a big one. And again, still going on. We were one of the early law firms working in partnership with the Office of Hawaiian Affairs when claimants, Hawaiian homesteaders, were able to seek damages for what became the Kalima case. And, you know, that made big news about 2 years ago when it was finally settled. We ultimately, that case was transitioned to a different firm to handle the class action. But that is something that we started out helping community with in the early days of it when everybody needed to make individual claims and have continued to be a part of the network of attorneys trying to help make sure that people who should be the beneficiaries of that settlement get access to the services they need. And unfortunately, there's many cases where those claimants have passed, and so now there's, you know, probate issues involved in finally getting the monies that they are deserved out to their families.
I just wonder, you know, what does, like, the emergence of environmental court, how has that made a difference with your cases? Any at all?
Well, specialty courts, you know, we deal with specialty courts in more than one area of our practice. So, for example, we just launched in February a family law practice because Native Hawaiians are far too often removed. Native Hawaiian children are removed from their families, and in some instances, they're placed with non-Hawaiian families that move away, and it basically severs their connection to their Hawaiian community identity. So, you know, that's another area of our practice where there's specialty courts. You know, what specialty courts do is it helps to ensure that the people who are looking at the cases that they are, you know, within the scope of the specialty court are judges who are really familiar with the subject matter. So, you know, in general, specialty courts are a good thing. By default, most courts that folks go into are sort of general courts, which means that, you know, you're talking to a judge who is expected to make decisions on any number of a broad range of issues, I mean, civil and criminal. And, you know, within the civil law, even just the law that we practice at NHLC, there's at least 9 distinct practice areas that fall within this broad umbrella called Native Hawaiian rights. So specialty courts are generally a positive thing because it means that you're before judges who just get to focus on the issue that is the subject of the specialty court.
And how has the change in laws changed the way you operate and what cases you choose?
Well, a couple things. One, you know, it's our duty to adapt and evolve to what the Native Hawaiian community needs. Now, in 50 years, there's some things that are just consistent and we don't see an end in sight. So in the earliest days of NHLC, the focus was on helping people who were being evicted by large landowners using the legal theory of adverse possession to basically say that they had their lands occupied without permission, but there's a theory in American law that was about promoting expansion and frankly taking of lands from a lot of different Native and people of color by settlers. And so this doctrine evolved, and, you know, honestly, it's kind of crazy that it exists, and the justifications for it basically don't make any sense in a modern context, but it allows people to say, I occupied your lands without your permission, and I did it for a long enough period of time that they now belong to me, and you don't get any compensation. And so that theory was used to evict Native Hawaiians en masse out of many valleys, and there was protests on the streets in the 70s about it, and we were formed as really a referral service to help make sure those people got counsel to participate in those eviction proceedings.
When it comes to, like, constitutional law, you know, when that's changed as well.
Yeah, I mean, we were founded before that, right? So, you know, it was within the first decade of our existence that you ended up having the CONCON, and then through that you got protections for Native Hawaiian traditional and customary practices, which we then started to leverage right away, right? And so that's been, you know, the majority of our time, but that wasn't really our origin. So we continue to work on the origin story work, which is helping Native Hawaiian families keep their family-owned lands. And then also something that existed at our founding was the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. And so we worked on homesteader rights as well. It wasn't until after the CONCON where we got, you know, fantastic protections for Native Hawaiian practices, but also the natural environment in Hawaii. Hawaii has some of the most progressive environmental law in the country, and part of that is rooted in our constitutional protections for the environment. And then we started to, of course, start using that law and practicing in those areas. So, you know, you definitely saw a lot of evolution in the first 10 to 15 years of NHLC because the social and legal landscape was changing so rapidly. But change hasn't stopped, right? In the last few years, you know, in my time at the firm, the family law program is a big deal. We're doing more on the civil side to help people who've been impacted by the justice system with expungement, both at the juvenile and the adult level, especially Kia'i, who have, you know, been impacted by the justice system in their defense of the environment, lands, sacred sites, things of that nature. Civil, not criminal, but, you know, important for those folks. We've also tried to follow along with the community as they need more on intellectual property and cultural heritage issues, which is sort of the intangible companion to all the cultural heritage work we've done for, you know, generations on the tangible parts of our culture, right?
Whether right, but burials. That's the next then chapter, the next phase.
I mean, it's all cultural heritage, cultural integrity, mm-hmm. but it's the non-physical aspect that we're now turning to.
We've been hearing from Makalika Naholova'a, the executive director of the Native Hawaiian Legal Corporation. She was reflecting on the firm's 50-year history and its mission to preserve and perpetuate Hawaiian culture.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories, as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30, here on HPR One.
This Saturday night on The Real Deal, the music of Leonard Bernstein. From Billie Holiday and Tony Bennett to the Stan Kenton Orchestra featuring Gabe Baltazar. Hope you can join me, Seth Marco, this Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR One.
The race to save the Hawaiian honeycreepers. For the past year, the multi-agency partnership Birds Not Mosquitoes has been releasing sterile male mosquitoes on Maui. The method, known as incompatible insect technique, aims to reduce the number of disease-spreading non-native southern house mosquitoes. And they are releasing 500,000 mosquitoes a week and recently hit the 14 million mark. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Krista Seidel of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project to get the latest.
We deploy the mosquitoes in specific locations here on East Maui that are within a permitted area. We had an environmental assessment that occurred in 2022. And so we have locations that we've identified that have mosquito populations, but are also adjacent to endangered forest bird habitat that ideally we can reduce the number of mosquitoes in those locations so that that benefits the birds that are upslope. We don't release mosquitoes right on top of the most endangered birds because where there are endangered birds, there's generally either no mosquitoes or very few, and there's not avian malaria. They're there for that reason. So we're releasing it just lower than that. So we deploy mosquitoes currently using helicopters. And so we pick up the mosquitoes from the airport. We do some amount of processing to get them out of their packaging. And then we put them in a helicopter and we deploy them at set locations. It's a little bit like it's a video game. So you're flying over points and you deploy a pod of mosquitoes at different points along a grid. And that happens twice a week, every week. And we receive per shipment 250,000 mosquitoes. So that means every week we deploy 500,000 mosquitoes in the areas that we're treating. We release these biodegradable, they're basically paper pulp pods. There's about 1,000 male mosquitoes in each pod. They're released under the helicopter through a chute. They fall and the mosquitoes are dispersed out as the pod is falling. We generally fly about 100 feet above the forest canopy or a little lower. It kind of depends on the weather conditions. We have some of the world's best helicopter pilots that we use to do this work. They're the same pilots, you know, that help fight fires. And we have captured male mosquitoes in our mosquito traps, which are on the ground. So we know that some amount of them do make it all the way to the ground. I think it's important to note that they are male mosquitoes, which do not bite. And they don't transmit diseases. Their main function is to go out and mate with wild females. And when they mate with wild females, the eggs that she lays won't hatch. And that results in an overall reduction in the number of new mosquitoes and thus the population of mosquitoes that are in the area being treated.
And so that's kind of one half of it. But then the other half, of course, is monitoring. What does your team's work then entail in addition to the helicopter deployments?
Yeah, so we monitor mosquitoes in the field, and IIT has been done all over the world. We here are one of the first projects to be doing it in such a remote landscape and also for wildlife conservation. So my team is hiking into areas where, first of all, there are barely trails. Second of all, it's very steep, it's muddy, it's wet, it's mosquito breeding habitat. And they might be carrying CO2 tanks and batteries in their backpacks. And those add up. So think about heavy backpacks sinking into the mud up to your knees. And they're checking these traps that are out in the field. And those traps use CO2, carbon dioxide, as an attractant. And so they're checking these traps that are, CO2 traps. They collect little baggies of mosquitoes. They go out. We'll have monitoring periods about once a month for multiple days in a row. They will look for mosquitoes in the baggie. They'll tally them up. They'll identify them by species and by sex. We do catch males sometimes in the same traps. And then we use that data over time between areas we treat and comparable areas we are not treating, so known as control sites. And we look at differences over time in the catch rates. And if we see significant differences that persist in those catch rates over time, we have stronger evidence that the mosquitoes are being suppressed in the locations we're deploying pods.
These goals aren't something that you can say you've met by the end of the year or even put a time to it. Why is it going to take longer than, simply a year or 2 years?
So generally, mosquito populations are very variable across time and space. And part of the reason for that is that they're very much tied to climate. And so right now, we're coming up on one of those peak seasons. That being said, things like El Nino events or just variation between years in the climate, in cold years, there are fewer mosquitoes. So we might just see very few mosquitoes, both in the areas that we are applying IIT and the areas that we aren't. And if those numbers are too similar, it would be hard to really pull out whether IIT was working. So we want to ideally get a couple seasons of peak mosquito seasons to really assess how well this is working. The more data you have, the more confidently you can answer the questions that you're asking. And ecological processes don't always follow our human timelines. So a couple years may even be too quick to answer some of the questions, for example, like the bird response to IIT suppression, incompatible insect technique. We don't suspect that we will see large changes in bird populations in response to 1 year's worth of mosquito deployments. So that's just something that we are keeping in mind for as how soon we should see results from this work.
And is there anything else that you want to add, anything you want listeners to be aware of going into year two of this program?
Mosquito control at this point for Hawaiian honeycreepers is really one of the last best options. Their number one threat is avian malaria and mosquito spread disease. And this is the best tool we have to address that. Hawaii was once an island of mostly birds, and we have an obligation, again, it's our kuleana, to protect these species and allow them to persist here in Hawaii, which is, they are the original inhabitants of these islands.
That was Krista Seidel, Mosquito Research and Control Coordinator with the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. And, scientists are also hoping to supplement the helicopter drops with a new tool, drones. We caught up with Adam Knox of the American Bird Conservancy, who is leading the partnership's drone team.
There's quite a lot you can do with drones as a tool. I mean, the two that come to mind, most commonly are the use of spray drone systems to do pest control, either, spraying weeds with the drone or insects with the pesticide. And that can remove the need to send a person in close to the infestation. And also, typically, people are only able to reach so high without other implements like ladders or other more complicated equipment, whereas a drone, you can just fly up over the area, whether it's a tall tree or a difficult terrain, and apply the treatment. And the second part is for aerial imaging. So conservation, for as long as I, you know, have been in this type of work, has very heavily relied on mapping and spatial software and satellite imagery to accurately define where the the problem sets are with invasive species or the areas of highest conservation concern. But those maps have limits. That satellite imagery has limits. That's up in outer space. And so having a drone essentially brings that satellite down, you know, to 100 feet or even less over the ground, or whatever resolution you'd like to get. You can have that with a drone by just flying it over the area that's affected. And where we kind of differ a little bit is we're more in like a delivery type space. And you may have seen and heard, you know, on the news, this concept of delivery drones, like delivering packages. And so we're more akin to, with what we're doing with the mosquitoes, to doing that sort of operation to get them out into the forest.
Was this something that kind of the Birds Not Mosquitoes team agreed on early on, that this was always going to be part of the process and it's just taken a bit to kind of get off the ground?
Yeah, it's been always been part of the plan, and the drone business in general and the technology and the regulations are constantly changing. And so, you know, as things have gone on, we've adapted to that and kept on pushing essentially with, you know, all the regulations and laws we need to comply with to keep the program moving. Most notably, the need to use compliant aircraft that are compliant with U.S. laws for procurement. And that pretty much limits us to American-made aircraft, which can have longer lead times than things that you might buy off the counter or online, like a DJI drone. But yeah, we are making excellent progress, you know, in terms of the technology, working with all the vendors and getting prepared to be able to do it.
Yeah. So what are the specs? How many drones are you sourcing? Do you already have? And what can they do?
Right now, we're still working with the vendors they have to build them. They're like custom made, essentially. We have three that are in various states of completion. I believe one is already completed. It's with another partner vendor in Florida right now, waiting to get shipped here. But as soon as we have them, yeah, we'll begin a nice long laundry list of field validation and testing. Because ultimately what we're trying to do is approximate like a helicopter mission, because that's the tool that we currently use to get the mosquitoes out there. And so we want to know sort of what it'll take in the field on each deployment mission with the drone and what we can expect.
Yeah, so what are the main benefits of using drones for these missions as compared to helicopters?
There's a few different sort of points, I guess, where drones fit really well into this picture. For one, as you mentioned, we use helicopters, and using that tool comes with risk, right? There's humans have to fly around in these things, and by eliminating the humans actually going up in the air in the aircraft, there's a little bit better safety profile because they're not actually flying around in the air. So that's one part of it. One of the most important parts, though, is with helicopters, we often have to make the best use of aircraft availability and weather windows, you know, based on what the vendor can do for us in terms of schedule and timing. With a drone, operating internally, we can pretty much operate on demand when conditions are best. And so that is a very big advantage, you know, moving into that direction. And it's also, there's, you know, lower impacts in terms of emission and just environmental impacts, you know, in terms of noise and other things, you know, on the environment.
And I imagine too, like personnel cost might be more cost effective.
Yeah, it can be more cost effective for sure. There's certainly a lot of efficiencies that can be gained by removing people in the aircraft. And obviously a drone is a lot lower cost than a multi-million dollar crewed aircraft. And so, yeah, we can definitely improve the sustainability and the bottom line.
And in terms of timeline, so what does it look like next? You're waiting for arrival of these three.
Yeah, you know, our plan is to, as soon as we have the aircraft, is to start testing right away. And then with the goal to be able to, you know, successfully demonstrate a mosquito drop in the forest by the end of this year. And so, you know, we're hoping that things go smoothly as they can in terms of finding out all the ins and outs of how the equipment will function in the environment and, you know, just improve as we go until we have the ability to do the mission.
Is the eventual goal to phase out some of the helicopter drops or kind of have this as an additional tool in the toolbox
Yeah, it's very dependent on the areas that we're working in. So some sites lend themselves better to working with drones where there could be like a full replacement, you know, of the helicopter. Mm-hmm. Other sites are more difficult and may not lend themselves as well. So it's yet to be seen, but, you know, it could either be sort of transitory where we transition to this new technology mostly, or supplementary where it greatly aids, you know, crewed aircraft, helicopters working out in the field. So we'll know more once we have a lot of testing and time built into doing this work. But for now, we hope that it can be a really, you know, at least a great supplement as we move toward that sort of transitory aspect of trying to make this a more sustainable, you know, long-term approach operating drones.
And that was Adam Knox with the American Bird Conservancy. A new documentary from Birds Not Mosquitoes called Vanishing Voices, Saving Our Forest Birds, will be premiering tonight at 6:30 p.m. on KGMB. We'll have more information on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
All those in favor of approving the platform, please say aye. All opposed, say no.
Democrats have a 2024 policy platform covering topics like the economy and immigration, but they wrote it when Joe Biden was the nominee. What do the Democrats stand for with Kamala Harris out front? And will that platform win over voters? I'm Tisiana Deering. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
You may remember musician Justin Kavika Young. He had 11 number one hits on Hawaii's radio stations in the late 1990s. The Kailua native first burst on the Oahu music scene after winning a songwriting contest in 1995 and releasing his first album the next year. In the 2000s, he moved to Los Angeles to build his career. Young was at one time engaged to award-winning musician Kobe Kale. The two were music collaborators and a couple for over 10 years. Today, Young splits time between Nashville and Oahu, and in recent years has put out solo albums and toured with national recording artists, and he released music with the new local band Seven Sons. The Conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with Young in our studios yesterday to walk down memory lane.
What's the song on that first album that holds the most memories for you?
Probably Windward Side. It was one of the first songs I ever wrote.
Was the song that you won the contest with, is that on your album?
Yeah, it was like, so it actually started as an economics project at Kala Hill, and we needed to market something. And I was known as the guy that would like carry his ukulele around and sing. And they're like, oh, we should do like a cassette tape of Justin's music. So we called up this random studio and he offered to donate time. We recorded 3 songs and then I submitted that to that studio because they held a contest and ended up winning, yeah.
What is it about Windward Side that holds the most memories for you?
I mean, it's where I grew up, and I think it was, yeah, one of the first songs that I wrote, and so it just feels really personal. It kind of reminds me of my childhood coming over the Pali, and I mean, still, when I come back to Oahu and I get to go home, taking that drive and coming through the tunnels and then and seeing that place that I grew up is special, and the Waihole store, my 4th grade teacher's family owns that store, so I mentioned that in the song too. Oh, so, and my mom taught in Waimanalo at Blanche Pope and at Kahuku, so we would take the drive when I would grow up, you know, up down to the North Shore to Kahuku.
Up onto the gully, it's a beautiful ride. Over the mountain to the windward side. Once you're through the tunnel, down below you.
From what I've read, you accumulated 11 number one hits on Hawaii radio before you moved to LA. Mm-hmm. And then when you moved, I imagine it was a transition like coming from being a big fish in a small pond to being a big fish in a humongous pond. What was that transition like for you? What did you learn during that time?
I think I never felt like a big fish, so there was kind of a relief to just go back there and have total anonymity. And like, I mean, not like I was a celebrity here, but you know, my natural nature as a person is kind of antithetical to being on stage, because I really like, I'm an, kind of an introvert and kind of shy, and I don't really like being the center of attention. And so even at an early age, I realized there was kind of a, there was a beauty to the symmetry of the thing that I kind of feared the most was something that I loved the most, doing music. But, you know, I think I always wanted to do more than just like island music and wanted to experience other things. So, I mean, it was scary to leave, and it did take me a while to get my footing in LA, but I kind of liked that I could go to LA and feel like I was kind of starting over again. And then I get to come home and play shows with my friends and actually have people come to the shows. So it's a nice balance. I mean, if you ever, I've done this many times in my life where you go from being on a big tour, like, you know, I've toured with bigger artists in their band, and then I'll do like my solo tour and I'm back driving myself in a van around. So it's kind of nice to keep that balance.
I know that you toured with Kobe Calais for some time, even forming a band with her called Gone West. Mm-hmm. The Gone West song with the most streams is What Could Have Been. Mm-hmm. It's got 22 million streams on Spotify. But the song that caught my ear on that album is Tides.
Yeah.
Mostly because of the Hawaiian lyrics that you included at the end of the song. You know, we don't hear that very often from musicians that are not based here or bands that are not based here. What's the story behind Tides and the inclusion of Olelo Hawaii in the song?
Yeah, you know, it was a band project with Colby and two of our other friends. And I think in the process of making it, that song just felt like the ocean in a way. And we all came from different places. And we all felt like, even though we're coming together as one in a band, that we could also represent our unique perspectives, and they all have a love for this place. And so they were super encouraging. And, you know, also there's a lot more people from here moving out to Nashville, recording there, or doing country music. But even just a few years ago, there was a lack of representation of much diversity at all in country music, and felt like, oh, I could bring something unique to the song, and it fit, and they were all for it. And so I thought it was kind of cool to have a country record that had some Olelo Hawaii on it.
Yeah. You know? And you talk about a lack of diversity, but we look at country now and it seems like it's so diverse now. And I know that you split time between here and Nashville. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the different kinds of stories that are being told because there's more representation in country music?
Yeah. I mean, even though I live in Nashville and I was in a country band, I didn't grow up on country music, and my exposure to country music has mostly just been because I'm in proximity to it, and I've been on tour with Brett Young, who's kind of more of a pop country thing. But I think, you know, everyone benefits when there's greater diversity of perspective and life experiences, and especially in a genre that, you know, supposes to be one that tells stories and that is connected to like the people. So I think it's great. I think it could use more of it.
You have this long track record as a solo artist, and you've also done a handful of collaborations. You've been a guest on some songs, and you also have years of experience as part of a band. Mm-hmm. What do you get out of kind of going between all these different types of musical settings?
Well, besides getting paid for one more than the other.
right.
Which is important. Not that that should be the main thing, but to be able to keep doing what you love, you got to be able to eat. Well, one thing, when I started out, I struggled with being on stage and figuring out how being a performer worked for me. Mm-hmm. I think that's just because, like I said before, it's just not natural to me to be in the spotlight. So I really struggled with that for a long time. And the first time I actually got like praise on stage was when I joined Colby's band. And I did find the role to be a little bit easier for me to support someone than to be in the center of things. And all those experiences have led me to a place where I feel more comfortable on stage as a solo artist, when I realize, like, oh, I'm not really an entertainer. I just like to make music and I can just be on stage and be myself. And I don't have to like figure out what persona or how to put a show on. Yeah. I can just share my songs. And the Brett gig was a different experience because I'd never played keys really live before. But I came up in LA as a songwriter at the same time with Brett and with the other members of his band, Keaton Simons and Tony Luca and Billy Hahn, the drummer. So we all knew each other from back in LA. And when their keyboard player left, they're like, hey, can you play keys? And I was like, yeah, I can. So for me, it was like a challenge. I mean, it was also like, you know, coming out of the Gone West thing kind of coming to a close at the same time as COVID, and I couldn't start playing my own solo shows and I wasn't gigging with Colby anymore. This also offered me like a stable way to pay the bills, to be honest with you. And it was a challenge for me to try something new. I played with him for a year and a half. I just finished my last shows with Brett about a month and a half ago. And there's one song, Mercy, where it's just me and him and I'm just playing keys and it's just the two of us on stage. And I had a panic attack every time I had to play that song. So
oh, man.
I'm like, I don't know if I'm really cut out for this in the long term, because some of these backing musicians are like, the more the spotlight's on me, the more I feel pressure, especially when it's someone else's show. If it's my thing, if I mess up a little bit, like I can roll with it. And it's just, you know, it all presents different challenges. And it is gratifying to be able to support someone else in that way.
You recently put together a new band, Seven Sons.
Yeah.
To me, it's kind of like a super group of Hawaiian musicians, you know, kind of in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. To me, it kind of reminds me a little bit of like Sons of Hawaii.
Yeah.
How did the band come together?
Somebody was like, it's like your favorite musicians, you know, because these guys are just incredible. And some of the guys I've played with for 20 years, you know, they've backed me up. And some of the guys have been around a little bit newer, but we all just love each other and love playing music together. And, you know, me doing other stuff, we didn't get to play together that often. But I was out backing Brett, and they've backed a bunch of other wonderful musicians. So three of them had started this project where they were going to just kind of, you know, bring in different featured artists and back them up. And then we had talked one day about it, and they were like, yeah, I think we just need a lead singer. And I was like, hello, I sing lead. And they're like, well, you don't even live here and you're out on tour with Brett. And I'm like, I would quit everything to do this with you guys. Because, you know, we've all been doing it for a while. And it's like, how do we want to spend the rest of our time in music? And if we can spend our time together as a band, I mean, that's a dream. So it's been really fun. And it's a true collaboration. There's seven of us and we all just really, really admire each other. It's the most I've been excited about something in a long time.
The first song that you guys released is Many Feathers. Mm-hmm. In the chorus, you sing, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I had a hard time finding the
sing
lyrics.
Sing it.
No. That's not going to happen. So in the chorus, you sing, you and I are stars just like the sun. Waves to the shore, we come undone. But never broken when we stay together. Touching the sky takes many feathers.
You and I are stars just like the sun. Waves to the shore, we come undone. But never broken when we stay together. Touching the sky takes many feathers. Rise on the wings of us.
This seems like a theme for how we should be living our everyday lives. Mm-hmm. And maybe even like an underlying theme of the band, and for maybe even Hawaiians as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the lyrics to that song and how you guys wrote the song together?
Yeah, so that's one of the first songs I wrote with the band project in mind. And I didn't want it to just sound like another Justin song. And Sean Pimentel, who's the drummer and sort of like the heart of the band, you know, was talking to me about kind of his vision for like a big sound, like a festival sound and something that could go outside of Hawaii. And I just started singing this, and many feathers came out of my mouth when I was writing, and I was like, I don't know what that means, but it takes many feathers to fly. So, and it kind of became, the song is really a mission statement for the band where, you know, we've all supported other stars, and this is our opportunity for each of us to step into our own light and to, you know, lift each other up. And yeah, individual waves may break on the shore, but collectively as an ocean, we're still together. And I think the imagery of the feathers being, you know, so important in indigenous culture. So I think it can apply to things on a macro level, but also just as our band, it's kind of the thesis statement of why we came together. We're all beautiful and unique in our own ways, but when we come together, we can lift each other higher than we could have on our own.
Rise on the wings of us, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you have some solo shows coming up on Maui, the Big Island, and Oahu. Can you give our listeners the details of where they can see you perform?
So I will be at the MAC at the McCoy Theater on the 23rd in Maui. And then I'll be in Hilo at the Palace on the 24th. And then I'll be back on Oahu on the 31st at the Lounge Island Sound in Hawaii. I'll be playing with a couple of the guys from Seven Sun, so it'll be fun.
All right. Well, Justin Kavika Young, thanks so much for your time, man. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much. I love public radio. I'm really excited.
We've been hearing from local musician Justin Kavika Young. He was talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. Young will be performing on Maui tomorrow night, on the Big Island this Saturday, and on Oahu on August 31st. We'll have a link to all the information on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Thought that we were in controlling, just like that, our world capsized. Someday these tears will be water under the bridge.
Well, that's it for us for this hour. Up tomorrow, we tip our hat to Duke's Ocean Fest and the Paris Olympics of 1920. We hear about a new book focused on the golden age of swimming. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Apple, Google, or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.